Okay, so we're looking at functional groups, four functional groups, and you're going to be looking at others. Due Wednesday, midnight. One thing we have to decide about Wednesday is when to have, I'll have a review session. The exam will focus mostly, obviously, on quantum mechanics. There'll be a little bit at the end of this lecture and on Wednesday about history, but that's not going to be emphasized on the test. That'll be emphasized on the next test. So I'll give the review for Monday's exam on Wednesday because that will be done with quantum mechanics by then and you'll be working on that thing. What time should we have the review on Monday evening? I could do either 7 to 9 or 8 to 10. How many would come but could not come if it were 7 to 9? How many would come but could not come if it were 8 to 10? Can you come? You can come for part of that though? Okay. It looks like 8 to 10 has it from what I could see if the hands were up. So we'll do it 8 to 10 on... Or it could be 7:30 to 9:30. Would that accommodate people better or worse? 8 to 10. It'll be 8 to 10. Okay, so last time we got started looking at the frontier orbitals of the carbonyl group. And we saw that the HOMO looked like the thing we could call, from a plum pudding point of view, 3D XY. Up there, and we noted that it was involved in antibonding in the same way that the one labeled 2PY is involved in bonding between the unshared pair orbital, the P orbital on the oxygen on the left, and CH bonds on the right. Now, somebody asked whether this should not cause the molecule to fly apart if it's got electrons in an antibonding orbital. This is a very low level of bonding and antibonding. Why? Because there's so little overlap between the CH bonds, which are pointing out that way, and the O orbital, which is over here. There's just a little bit of overlap. The only practical effect it has, and that very minor, is to raise the energy of the unshared pair a little bit of the orbital that's on oxygen. You don't go far wrong thinking of that HOMO being an unshared pair on oxygen. But if you look at what the computer says, you see that it's a little bit mixed in an unfavorable way with the CH bonds. So it's a little higher than it would otherwise be, but not very much, not that you should lose sleep over it. Okay, so we saw that last time. So the HOMO of a carbonyl group is an unshared pair on oxygen. Right? More interesting for carbonyls, perhaps, is the LUMO, which is this thing which we could label 3DXZ, but normally you'd call that what? Do you know? Nobody, if you called it that, no one would know what you're talking about except someone in this class. You call it pi star. It's the antibonding pi orbital. Notice it's big on carbon and small on oxygen. Why would that be? Yeah.
Because that's where you least want to put the electrons to keep the bond together.
Right. It's the pi orbital that's the favorable one. Right, the bonding interaction of those same two atomic orbitals. And that one will be big on oxygen and small on carbon. What's left over for pi star is big on carbon and small on oxygen. So we can look at it here, that LUMO. And we see there's this nodal plane. Is that antibonding? No, that's just the node of the atomic orbitals. Sherry, before we go.
Why do we skip 3P?
What?
Why do we skip 3P from 2s? We go to 3P?
But you know, in atoms, you'd know what in a one electron atom, you know the order of the orbitals. In these molecular analogs, it depends on where the nuclei are. If the nuclei are where the orbital has big density, then it's a low energy orbital. But if the nuclei are elsewhere, then they get all mixed up. Okay, so that one we don't worry about. That's an atomic orbital node. But in between here is the antibonding node, of course, of the carbonyl. Now, why is it an unusually low LUMO? First, because the overlap isn't as good. I mean, it's a lot better than the overlap that caused that to be, that this orbital of oxygen to be mixed with those hydrogens. That's really bad overlap, right? But this overlap isn't as good compared to what? The pi overlap isn't as good as sigma overlap would be. Okay, so it's a low LUMO because poor overlap, it didn't get pushed up very much as a sigma would have been. And it's got poor energy match too, because the oxygen is a lower energy orbital than the carbon. Okay, and in fact, in this particular case, it's 45% oxygen and 55% carbon, and we talked about why it would be low on oxygen, because the oxygen is used elsewhere. It's used in that one that we labeled 2pz, which you normally would call the pi orbital. Now, the picture looks a little confusing. Let's look in more detail at that. There's the bonding pi orbital of C double bond O. Now, it should be what was used up so as to leave 45% oxygen and 55% carbon for the pi star. Right, so this one should be 55% oxygen and 45% carbon. Is that how it looks? What does it look like? It looks bigger on carbon than on oxygen, if you had to say, right? Here's what's going on here? Well, there's a solid picture of the same thing. And now, here's what's interesting. That contour is drawn at 0.003 electrons per cubic Bohr radius. Okay, that's the electron density for that particular picture. But now look what it looks like at 0.01, a higher density contour, or still higher, three times higher again, three times higher again. What do you notice? And here's 0.3, right? So what do you conclude? It is indeed more on oxygen than on carbon.
It's denser.
But the oxygen holds its electrons closer. Right? So if you look at high densities, then you see that it's big on oxygen. But if you look out at a low density, it looks like it's big on carbon. But indeed it is, as we would have expected. The bonding orbital will be bigger on the lower energy atom, oxygen. Okay, so oxygen holds its electrons more closely than carbon does. So you can be so when you see orbitals that are drawn at different orbital images that are drawn at different contours, you could be misled. That's why in those previous pictures you didn't look the same on the right and the left, the old style and the new style. They were drawn at different contours. And in fact, this same picture, this same consideration appears in the van der Waals radius, that oxygen has more electrons but a smaller radius. That doesn't seem right, does it? You'd think that a thing with more electrons would have a bigger radius. But in fact, it's smaller because the nuclear charge is holding them more tightly. Mike?
Okay, this is kind of a question from the previous slide. So you said that the 3D XY orbital was, you could think of it as the one unshared pair in the oxygen.
Yeah.
So are we supposed to be able to identify what the other unshared pair is supposed to be?
Yeah, it's another orbital on oxygen. It's another, it's a sigma. It's not, that's a pi orbital p, right? It's a p orbital like that. There's also a p orbital that would go this way in the plane, perpendicular to the p orbital that makes the pi bond, right? But in fact, it gets hybridized. It has some s in it. There's another, one sp hybrid is involved in the bond. This sp hybrid points out and holds the lone pair. So that's what the other one is. And you can see it in the picture there. We looked at it before. Okay. Now, in fact, this is it, right? That's that orbital. It's a hybrid on oxygen, p or sp hybrid on oxygen, but it's a little bit mixed with the CH sigma orbitals, okay? And again, this would look more dramatically on oxygen if we drew a lower contour. Okay, so it's the unshared pair that's in the sigma along the axis of the CO bond. Okay, and we can see that it has some CH bonding, that it's mostly a P-rich hybrid atomic orbital on oxygen, and there's some bonding to it too. So it's lower. That unshared pair is a little bit lower than you'd expect, whereas the other unshared pair is high. Okay, notice that these nodes go through the nuclei their atomic orbital nodes, not between the atoms. This is not an antibond. Okay, now here's a practical question, or a sort of practical question. From what, if you were a nucleophile, if you were a high homo looking for a place to make your electrons more comfortable, from what direction would you approach this vacant orbital, this LUMO of carbonyl? This is probably the most important reaction that carbonyls, the most important functional group, undergo, is attack by a high homo. So you could imagine coming from one of those directions. Do those look like, if you were a big high homo coming in, would those directions be good for you? Matt, why not? You need overlap. And those are all coming along nodes, right? So you're going to have plus on one side, minus on the other. It's orthogonal. So forget those. Better to come on the p orbital. So we could either come on the carbon p orbital or the oxygen p orbital. Which one would look better to you? Brian? Which one? I can't speak up. Why? Yeah, it's easier to get overlap with the carbon. That's where the orbital is big, right? So you're not going to do that one. In fact, there's another reason not to attack the oxygen too, because look what would happen if you were a nucleophile and formed a bond to oxygen. You'd be left with it's one of these make and break situations. You make the new bond, and the double bond electrons then go on the other atom. That's the second of the curved arrows. Right, but they would go onto carbon if you attack the oxygen, and onto oxygen if you attack the carbon. Much better to be in the low energy orbital of oxygen than in carbon. So from both points of view, where you get the good overlap and what you're going toward, where you're shifting that pair of electrons, the double bond pair of electrons, both say you should attack from the carbon. And in fact, until the 1980s, everyone thought that that arrow would be more or less, not that people thought about it all that much, but they thought that that was probably the direction perpendicular to the plane you'd come in and attack that carbon orbital. But in fact, that's not such a great way to attack it. Can you see a better direction to attack it? That's from 12 o'clock. Right? 12 o'clock direction. What o'clock do you think would be best? Will? What? What? 10 o'clock maybe, over there. Why? Aha, to get better overlap. There's where the nodes go. That's the furthest from the nodes. That's where you're going to get the best overlap. Now, can you experimentally tell what direction something would approach a carbonyl pi star orbital from? Well, you can. And the way you do it is to rotate. I'm going to rotate this so that it matches the orientation in a figure I'm going to show you. So here's a figure taken from a paper in 1983 by Burgi and Dunitz, where they did structure superposition. So they've had 14 different crystals. They're labeled A through O here, omitting J. Okay, so there are 14 crystals, and each of those crystals had a carbonyl group in it and had a nitrogen with an unshared pair, right? And now they look at how these are arranged in the crystal, because the crystal is a static arrangement of these groups, but the nitrogen could be different places, right, relative to the carbonyl. So see where it actually occurs, because each of these pictures could be a frame in a movie of where a nitrogen could be relative to carbon. So relative to the carbonyl. So here's the picture. So we have the carbon and the oxygen, which we draw. The carbon is the origin. Oxygen is drawn along a line down to the right. Okay, so that we're orienting the picture. So we're going to take all these 14 different structures, and we're going to put their carbons all here, and we're going to put the oxygens all along this line, though they could be at different distances along that line. Okay, then we're going to put the nitrogen. Incidentally, there's going to be an R group then of the carbonyl that's coming out toward us, and an R group that's going back into the board. Okay, and we're going to put the nitrogen in the plane of this picture up at the top, right? But in many different places in different crystals. Okay, and now we'll look at the patterns that are formed from one crystal to the next. the arrangement of these atoms, the C, the O, the R's, and the N. Right? So here's crystal number G. Right? It has the nitrogen there. Notice that the R is bent down a little bit. It's not up in the plane. There's another R behind this one. Okay? So there's G, H, I, K, no J, and L. Okay, so the nitrogen is coming down as you go from one frame to the next. The R's are bending down, and the oxygens are moving down to the right. So this is like frames of a movie of nitrogen attacking the carbonyl. Did everybody see how they did it? Any questions about the picture? Brian?
Is it always going to be the case that if we're further from the nodes, that's the best place to attack, or does it?
All we know is that all we know experimentally is that among these 14 crystals, they follow this trajectory, and most particularly among the five crystals that we showed there. They expanded it to a larger number later, and it shows the same kind of thing. But there seems to be a very, very prevalent trajectory for approach of nitrogen to the carbonyl group along that line, which is 110 degrees from the CO direction, right? So that's called the Burgi-Dunitz angle. That's the angle at which it approaches, and it's exactly what we showed up at the top with the blue arrow, right, that Will told us should be the best way for the nitrogen nucleophile to approach the pi star orbital of the carbonyl group. Okay, so that's what we're going to say about the carbonyl. Yeah, Aviva?
Was that angle specific for this one case?
What do you mean by one case? Yeah, they didn't do it with other nucleophiles. But we're talking about the carbonyl group, so obviously that's general, at least among this set of compounds.
It only applies with nitrogen?
Pardon me?
Does it only apply with the nitrogen?
Well, it was only studied with, in this particular case, it was only studied with nitrogen. They actually did some other trajectories of other functional groups in this same way by crystal structure superposition. Okay, but I don't think they did any other. I'm not sure. They might have done another nucleophile, but I don't know. But anyhow, you see why it should be that way. So once you see that indeed it is that way in the case of nitrogen, you sort of suspect it's going to be that way with other things, although it would be interesting to check. Okay, so now we're going to do the other three functional groups, amide, carboxylic acid, alkyl lithium as an example of an organometallic compound, and then we're going to have a complete change of perspective. Okay, so the amide groups show us something about resonance. Resonance, as we've alluded to before, is intramolecular homo-lumo mixing. We've looked at homo-lumo mixing between molecules, like the nitrogen attacking the carbonyl. You should be able to get the same thing within a molecule. And the amide functional group is an example of that. Remember, I insisted before when you were memorizing functional groups or answering on the first exam, that a thing like this not be called an amine and not be called a carbonyl, that it be called an amide because it's a different functional group. And now we're going to see why. We're going to compare the predictions we would have if it were an amine and a carbonyl to the predictions we would have if it's an amide, if they interact with one another, as we could indicate by looking at the homo-lumo in the first case, and by remembering in the second case that you can have that the high energy electrons on the nitrogen could indeed mix with the pi star orbitals of the carbonyl, just like an external nitrogen can attack the carbonyl. Of course, we're not telling the molecule anything. It was perfectly aware how the electron should be stable. It's that if we drew the picture as an amine ketone, we were missing the boat, because we didn't take into account that that pair of electrons on the nitrogen should be more stable because they won't be staying on the nitrogen. So it's our naivete that gives rise to resonance. Okay, so now we're going to compare the naive prediction, if it's an amine carbonyl, with the experimental observation. So the prediction would be that that has a certain stability, but the one on the right should be more stable because the electrons get lowered in energy compared to what they were in an amine. And indeed, amides are about 16 kilocalories more stable than you would expect for an amine carbonyl. And we'll talk later about exactly what that expectation is based on. But 16 kilocalories is not chopped liver. It's a quarter as strong as a sigma bond. So it's quite substantial, this amount of resonance stabilization in the amide group. Here you'd expect a certain CN bond length, but it should be shorter in the case of mixing the nitrogen with the carbonyl because you have a new bond, a new bonding interaction. So you should get a shorter CN partially double bond, and indeed it's shorter than CN single bonds by 0.14 angstroms, which is about 10% of a bond distance. Okay, you'd expect on the left a normal short CO double bond, but on the right it should be somewhat longer because you're putting electrons into the antibonding pi star orbital. And indeed, it's lengthened by about 0.3 angstroms over normal carbonyls, which don't have a nitrogen next door. On the left, you'd expect a pyramidal nitrogen. That's what we've, remember, XH3, an amine should be pyramidal, bent out of the plane. But on the right, it should be planar in order to accommodate that double bond to give the best overlap between the P orbital on nitrogen and the pi star orbital of the carbonyl. And indeed, amides are planar. There's the pi star, the LUMO, here's the nitrogen HOMO, and if you're going to delocalize that HOMO into the LUMO to make a resonance stabilized situation, then you have to have the bonds on the nitrogen in the plane. So you have that P orbital, not some SP hybrid that's pointing out to the right someplace. Okay, so to give a partial CN double bond and a partial CO single bond. Okay, so that's what gives the best overlap. Now, if it were just a single bond between carbon and nitrogen, then you wouldn't hurt the overlap by rotating around that about that bond, right? So single bonds have easy rotation. But there's a barrier to rotation if you have the unshared pair overlapping, because you break that overlap, as you can see in the picture here, if you turn the thing 90 degrees halfway to having rotated, right? And in fact, if you get to that point, now there's no reason for the nitrogen to be planar anymore. It might as well be pyramidal. And in fact, if you arrange an amide such that it's twisted, then it is pyramidal. Okay, and the barrier to this rotation, you can measure how fast that thing rotates. You use NMR, and we'll talk about that later on. You can use NMR to measure that rate. From the rate, you can get how high the barrier is that you have to get over when it's perpendicular, as shown here. And that barrier is 16 kilocalories per mole, which you'll notice is the same as we had up here. That's how much that resonance is worth, the special stability of the unshared pair on nitrogen. Okay? And if it were an amine and a carbonyl, then you expect it to be both basic and acidic. It has an unusually high HOMO and an unusually low LUMO, as we've been discussing. But if it's an amide, then those two mix within the molecule, and you have a lower HOMO and a higher LUMO, not so special anymore. So it's not very reactive. So it's relatively unreactive. An experimental example of that is skin works, right? Your skin works. It doesn't dissolve if you go swimming or take a shower, right? Or if you touch a base in lab, it doesn't suddenly dissolve your skin. I mean, you don't want to leave it on there a long time, but it doesn't instantly dissolve your skin as it would if it were a carbonyl group, right? Okay, so And here, if it were an amine carbonyl, we'd have a dipole moment in the molecule. We could look at how the electrons shift. They're shifted toward oxygen from carbon, toward nitrogen from carbon in the sigma bond, right? So those two things taken together would give the overall molecule a dipole moment that would point to the right, right? The resultant of those two bond dipoles, right? And largely they cancel one another. They're pointing mostly in opposite directions, but they reinforce a little bit to the right. Okay? But notice that in the amide, right, the plus charge on nitrogen and minus charge on oxygen would give a big dipole moment pointing from bottom to top. So it's a strong dipole and in the perpendicular direction. And that turns out to be true. Right, and the magnitude of the dipole is what you would calculate if you moved a third of an electron from nitrogen to oxygen. So that's sort of how big this effect is. It's enough shift that is this resonance structure on the right is worth about one third of that charge transfer that you see there. Mostly, it still looks like this, but one third of an electron has been transferred. Okay, now these four properties of an amide make it one of the most important groups in structural biology. That's what all proteins are based on, and their properties is that, of course, that it's stable, that it's relatively unreactive, the skin works, but also that the nitrogen is planar, that there's a barrier to rotation, and that it's strongly dipolar. All these are very important, and we'll show you some examples of this. So here's an amide, simple amide, form amide, and that's what the orbital would look like. You would have guessed it was the unshared pair on nitrogen, the HOMO. But in fact, the HOMO looks like this. It's still substantially on nitrogen, but a lot of it is shifted over to the oxygen, and it has a node between them. Okay, and that gives rise to this electric dipole, as we just discussed. Okay, now, but this amide group appears in proteins. For example, it appears in the alpha helix structure of a protein chain. So there's the backbone goes along that helix, the so-called alpha helix. But that amide group in the middle has that dipole moment that we show there. But that's not the only amide in the chain, of course. If we unwrap the chain, you can just see the structure underneath. There's another dipole there and another dipole on the left. And they're lined up so as to be favorably attractive to one another, right? And in fact, it's not only that one. It's not only the overall interaction of these two dipoles. This positive nitrogen makes the hydrogen on it particularly positive. And this oxygen, we already said, was negative. And they're quite close to one another. So if you get positive next to negative, that's favorable. And you know what you call that? You call that a hydrogen bond when you get plus near minus. Why hydrogen bond? Why not other things that are dipolar? Because hydrogen is so very small. So you can get other things very close to it. So you can get big interactions with the plus on hydrogen when you couldn't get such a big interaction with a plus on something else because you couldn't get so close to it without the occupied orbitals running into one another. Okay, so this hydrogen bonding is very important, and it's not only that chain. There's also a chain from that oxygen and there going along the top, and another hydrogen bonded chain going along the bottom. Okay. So we have these hydrogen bonds holding the molecule together and the dipoles, which are just a reflection of that dipole of the amide group. Okay? But furthermore, we have this local planarity of that partial double bond between carbon and nitrogen. As you see in this carbon, here's the carbonyl group, here's the nitrogen, and these groups attached to the carbon and nitrogen, the carbon here, the hydrogen, the oxygen, and this carbon, are all in the same plane. You can't twist easily about that bond. It would cost 16 kilocalories per mole to twist. So we have that one. We also have this one here. We also have that one in the back, right? So one third of the bonds along this helix, one third of them don't allow rotation, right? So that helps it keep the helix shape. If it were free to rotate around all the bonds and very floppy, then it would be hard to stay in the helix shape, right? But if some of the bonds are required to be to have no easy rotation, to be planar, then you can do it. So this reduces the potential floppiness of the backbone by a factor of a third, to have one third of the bonds be of restricted rotation. Okay, now that's the amide. Now let's look at carboxylic acid. So we could compare an alcohol group of a normal alcohol, ROH, with the alcohol group, so-called, of a carboxylic acid. And I'm going to maintain that that's not an alcohol group. It's a carboxylic acid, not an alcohol and a carbonyl, in the same way that an amide was not an amine and a carbonyl, because you can have this resonance stabilization or homo-lumo mixing within the molecule that needs to be taken into account. So, an alcohol, or water for that matter, where R is H, is a little bit of an acid, right? It has a pKa about 16 for dissociation. It's not a favorable thing to happen in water, but it happens a little bit. 10 to the minus 16th is the equilibrium constant. So, if the bottom molecule were also an alcohol, we'd expect something like that, but in fact it's ever so much more favorable. It's 10 to the 11th times stronger as an acid than an alcohol is. There's something special about having the carbonyl group next door. It must be less uphill in energy to lose the proton in this case than it is to lose the proton from a normal alcohol. Now, let's see if we can understand why it should be less uphill in energy in the case of the carboxylic acid. Call it an acid because of that. Now, for example, we could look at the right, at the left here, and see there's an unshared pair on the oxygen pointing in and out of the plane, but it can overlap with the carbonyl pi star to become more stable, right? Which we could denote using Lewis structures by this resonance structure. Okay, so the HOMO shown here, that unshared pair on the oxygen that we guessed was the HOMO naively, in fact isn't that. It's stabilized pi star. It mixes with that LUMO, and that mixing stabilizes this compound. Everybody with me? So it should be more stable than we would have guessed if we didn't take that mixing into account. But if you lower the energy of what's on the left, that'll make it even more uphill to go to the right. So this is backwards from what we're trying to explain. Is everybody clear on that? If we make the left more stable, that's going to make it harder to climb the hill in energy to the right to lose a proton, right? But in fact, it's 10 to the 11th times easier to climb that hill. Why? This seems backwards. What haven't we taken into account yet? We took into account resonance stabilization of this pair of electrons here. But what haven't we taken into account? Mirov?
Like when you shift the electrons to the antimon.
Yeah, we haven't taken into account what happens over here. Good. Okay, so we got a pair of electrons there too. So we're going to get HOMO-LUMO mixing here too, and that really stabilizes the carboxylate anion. Why is it so much more effective on the right than it was on the left? Why do you get more HOMO-LUMO mixing with this HOMO than you did with that HOMO? What determines how much mixing you get, Jordan?
Is it because of the negative charge on the right?
So what?
It allows for greater overlap.
Not that it's greater overlap. The overlap's going to be the same. No, don't talk electronegative with me, Kathy. Sorry. What? It's going to be a higher energy HOMO because of the negative charge. So you're going to get more mixing, better energy match with the LUMO. Right? So it's a higher HOMO because of that negative charge. So you get more, you get stabilization on the left, but you get even more stabilization on the right because of the higher HOMO. So that's what makes the, so it's now not so much uphill. right? So that's why a carboxylic acid is a carboxylic acid, not an alcohol carbonyl. Okay, and finally, the fourth functional group is an organometallic compound, the simplest case being methyl lithium. So there's the structure of methyl lithium. The orange atom, obviously, is lithium. And here's what the HOMO looks like. It's a sigma bond, right, which is mostly on carbon. Does that surprise you, that the sigma bond is mostly on carbon? Henry, why doesn't it surprise you?
Because carbon has more protons too.
Right. Carbon has a lot more protons. They're using the same N. Lithium and carbon are using the same quantum level. N is 2 for both of them. Right? But carbon has a lot more, three more, well, count them here. Lithium, there's 1, 2, 3 more protons in the nucleus. So it's a lower energy orbital. So you expect the favorable combination to be low on carbon. Indeed it is. So there's an atomic orbital node here. There's also an atomic orbital node here on lithium, but the lithium's so small you don't see it very well. And it's bonding between them. They're overlapping favorably. Okay, so there's the HOMO sigma. Here's the LUMO. The LUMO is practically all on lithium. The HOMO is practically all on carbon. It's a very ionic bond. The electrons are very unevenly shared. Okay, and there is the LUMO plus 1, the next highest orbital. The second vacant orbital is this one, which is a P orbital on lithium. It's hard to draw using this program because those electrons are so weakly held that they go way out, right? So it's not easy to draw. But anyhow, that's what it looks like. And now let's take another methyl lithium, right? And it has its HOMO and LUMO. For example, that HOMO. So the molecule has an unusually high HOMO. And we talked about that. In fact, that I think was one of the compounds we mentioned as having an unusually high HOMO because the lithium, here's the normal carbon. Lithium was up here. The carbon didn't go down very much, right? So unusually high HOMO, but also an unusually low LUMO, or LUMO plus 1 even. Okay, so these two things, so methyl lithium can react with methyl lithium. Those two can overlap, stabilizing a little bit the electrons that are in this bond. Okay, but at the same time, what else happens? Oh, okay, Derek, what's...
Why is it a low LUMO?
Why is it low? Because it didn't mix with anything, right? It was an atomic orbital that didn't become a star orbital, right? Most of the orbitals we're comparing with are sigma star, for example, that went up. This is an atomic orbital lithium that never went up. Started high because it didn't have much nuclear charge, but it never went up. So it's low. Unusually low. Mike?
Isn't the high energy to start out with because of the low nuclear charge?
Yes.
So how do you know compared to the CH star orbital that it's not going to be higher than it to start out with?
You don't know that, absolutely. But you know it empirically because of reactions like this, that this is a good reaction. Right, that this is a lower energy. It's like what we did, a little bit like what we did with looking at the bonding and antibonding combination of a P orbital on oxygen with the CHs, which is big, which is small. Now we know which is lower. It's a similar kind of thing here. Okay, so we can also have the LUMO plus 1 of the molecule on the bottom stabilize the electrons in the HOMO on the top. It's the same thing upside down, just exchanging their roles. Right, so that could be stable. So that means there's going to be bonding between these two. Each of them is going to stabilize the electrons of the other one. So the two will come together and form a dimer, right? And it'll look like this. Okay? And those electrons of CH3 minus, we can say, are stabilized, each of them, by two vacant orbitals of lithium. Right? Each lithium stabilizes two pairs of electrons. And the carbon, the electrons that could be thought of as on the carbon in that lowest energy orbital, mostly on carbon, are actually stabilized by two lithiums, not one. Did you ever see anything like this before?
Wow.
Right. It's exactly the same thing as B2H6. Right? So these are three center, two electron bonds. And that, but notice the lithium, lithium plus, has four vacant orbitals. This only uses two of them. If we think of this thing as being made by CH3 minus Li plus, the limit of the ionic structure, right? The lithium plus has four valence level orbitals that it can use to stabilize electrons. And here, each lithium has used two of them. One to stabilize this electron pair, one to stabilize that electron pair in the dimer. Ah, it's still got two to go, each lithium. Okay, now there's the LUMO of this dimer calculated, and there's the LUMO plus one. So these LUMOs are sticking out, able to stabilize more electrons. So now this is a complicated thing, and in fact, a couple slides later, I think it'll become clearer. But just to show you, I'm going to rotate this molecule about that axis, so that the view I'm going to take is I'm going to be looking at this red lobe here, and it's going to be more or less on top of the red one in back. So I'm going to rotate this thing up that way. Okay, so there it is, rotated about that axis. Here we go. All right, so now the two red lobes are more or less on top of one another. So the plane is going like this. We're not looking right at the edge of the plane. Right, but behind, I'm going to draw an axis that goes down through that molecule, and then through and bring another molecule in a parallel plane up underneath it from the back. Right, and now I'm showing the LUMO of each of them, but I want to look at the HOMO of one interacting with the LUMO of the other. So I'll make the HOMO of the one on the bottom. And now this is not only beneath, but back into the board from this one. Okay, but now see, I could have that blue one overlap with that blue one, and that red one overlap with the back red one on the top, and get stabilization. Right? Or, if I look at the HOMO on the top and the LUMO on the bottom, right, I was looking at the HOMO on the bottom and the LUMO on the top. But if I do it the other way around, I can see it even more clearly. If I had been thinking, I would have used this perspective in the first place rather than the one I showed. Okay, so anyhow, again, the HOMO of one dimer stabilizes the LUMO, or is stabilized by the LUMO of the other dimer, and vice versa.
In the HOMO, are the four lobes linear to each other?
Are they what?
Are they linear to each other?
In the HOMO, yeah, they're along a single line.
On a single plane.
Yeah, they're along a line, not just a plane. Okay, so that means that these two things are going to attract one another, stabilize each other's electrons. So those are going to come together, and you're going to get a cube. It's four CH3 lithiums, right? And notice, this is the HOMO of that cube. In fact, there are four orbitals like this. This is one of them, and what you see it is a four center. We looked at three center two electron bonds. This is a four center two electron bonds. It's this unshared pair of CH3 minus being stabilized by this lithium and this lithium and this lithium. Right? Or we could look at it on the top right by drawing a tetrahedral set of lines where we drew a Y to show a three-center two-electron bond. This is a four-center two-electron bond, right? And there are going to be four of them, one from each carbon, right? Now there's still a vacant orbital on lithium. It had four. See, this lithium, for example, here, is stabilizing that electron pair and that electron pair and that electron pair. But it has another vacant orbital. So it could stabilize another electron pair coming from the top. Now, it doesn't do it with another methyl lithium. It does it with solvent. So if you have an ether, for example, with an unshared pair, it attaches to one of the lithiums, and obviously other ethers can attach to the other lithium. So you get this structure, a tetramer of methyl lithium holding on to four ether molecules. Now you have to be careful when you put the ether in there, because if you put too much ether in, It'll use some of the lithium, other molecules of oxygen, we'll use some of the ether, we'll use some of the lithium vacant orbitals instead of other methyl lithiums. So if you put too much excess ether in, it'll rip these aggregates apart, and what you'll get is a single methyl lithiums, and each lithium then holds on to three ethers if you have plenty of ether. But if you only have enough ether, you'll form this cube with four ethers attached. And that's about as complicated, I think, as we need to get. Do you agree? Okay, so that's where we'll stop with methyl lithium. And now we have, but I want to make the point that here we have ether being associated with this thing, that non-bonded interactions and solvent effects are a very vital part of lore. It's hard to predict these kind of things because they're very weak, difficult to predict these last interactions, and they can, extra ether can break the thing apart and so on. So solvent effects are very important, but we'll talk about them later on. We're just looking at things bonding within molecules to begin with. Now, I was going to do a little demonstration of doing a Spartan thing so you could see how it worked. Why don't I do that on Wednesday evening? And I'll just end here with two. So the idea is that you choose a functional group, and I'll enter it. In fact, if anybody wants to stay after class, if you don't have to run, we could do it now and also on Wednesday evening, just so you see what's involved. So if somebody suggests a functional group, we'll put it in and see what we get for orbitals. Okay, so we've seen this far, we're almost halfway through the course, we've seen amazing modern tools that show the world of molecules and the atoms within them at high detail, angstrom distances and picoseconds in time and these vibrations and so on. So we've seen scanning probe microscopy and X-ray diffraction and spectroscopy, IR and ESR, and we'll be talking about NMR later on, and all these fabulous things. And we've talked about quantum mechanics, which has become so reliable that people who do it talk about doing experiments with their computer, right? Whereas from my point of view, experiments you do with molecules, calculations you do with computers. But anyhow, people talk about computer experiments. So this is just fabulous, right? But the amazing thing, and this hasn't been available very long, right? The last 30 years maybe this has been really widespread. Some of it goes back further than that. But the amazing thing is that no organic chemist was surprised by what these things showed when you could actually see them. Why? Because they already knew how atoms were arranged in molecules and how they moved, how things reacted. How could they possibly know these things that were not visible before X-ray came along? Right? That's the question. How did they know? Right? So that's what we're going to start. And we saw, when we were looking at history, we saw that science began in the 17th century and the force laws were discovered, Hooke and Coulomb. And Coulomb is it, right? By 1800, we had the potential energy that controls atoms and molecules. Of course, we had to wait for the 20th century and Schrödinger to be able to do the kinetic energy properly so that we could understand bonds, we could observe bonds experimentally, we could do quantum mechanics. But what we've left out here is what happened in the 19th century that made organic chemists not surprised when they could do this calculations and actually seeing things in the 20th century. So this is where the organic structural model and the notation we use and the words we use, this is where it actually developed. So this is what most of organic chemistry is. I mean, of course, it expanded dramatically in the 20th century, but it's all based on these ideas that developed in the 19th century. So what we're going to do for the next several weeks is look at what experiments people did in the 19th century and how they developed these ideas of chemical bonding. Okay. So if anybody wants to see Spartan of a functional group, come and suggest one and we'll try it out.
We try metal alkyls?
We actually just did metal alkyl.
Like metal alkyl.
That's what we just did. Methyl lithium is a metal lithium alkyl methyl. So I think there'll be more interesting things to do than that. We can do it, but I've just shown you its orbitals.
Where did you get this program? Or is it not... Is it too complicated?
I bought it. I bought it. They charge like $400 for it or something like that. Yeah. There are others. There are other programs that are free that you can use, but the problem is they don't have such good graphic interfaces. I don't think many of them don't, anyhow. So it's much easier to manipulate with this, which is why I use it.
Plus, Yale probably pays for it. Does Yale pay for it?
For when I bought this? Well, I mean, I have a budget that I use that I bought it with. Yeah.
Can we look at enol or enol?
Enol. Okay, we'll do that. Okay, so let me just quit this first.
Okay, so for example, if I didn't have this program, like, a lot of the estimations that we did in the lecture, I'm, like, not sure how you would get to that from scratch.
Yeah, well, you know, the point of doing this, you got the email that I sent about this that said the point is not to try to match wits with a computer.
Right, right.
It's to see that if you start with Lewis structure and look at bonds but have the idea of also antibonds, where they're likely to, where the orbitals are big and small, whether they're unusually high or low in energy, you can predict a lot of these things without any... The reason we've used the computer is just to calibrate ourselves about whether what we were doing was reasonable, right? So you don't have to do it.
But I mean, what if you like make a wrong estimation, or like make a wrong guess?
Well, but if you do it, the point is to exercise your brain to be thinking about these things. And if you're wrong, then later you'll learn that you're wrong, and then you'll go back and correct your web page.
Okay.
Hello.
Reggie.
I didn't really understand the experiment.
Just a second, I have to make sure to save this.
Yeah, I didn't really understand that.
Okay, it wasn't, in a sense, it wasn't an experiment. There's a computer database that has lots and lots of coordinates of atoms in different crystals. So you could go online and find all the crystals that have a carbonyl group and an amine in it.
Okay.
So they did this. They found all of those.
Okay.
And then they looked for ones where the amine happened to be generally in the vicinity of the carbonyl group. There would be some where it was so far off it was irrelevant. So they got in this. They got 20, whatever number, a certain number of structures that had both an amine and a carbonyl and their reasonable proximity to one another. And now they try to see where do those amines fall in the neighborhood of a carbonyl. And what you hope is that there'll be, what they hoped and what proved to be true was that there'd be some where the attraction is happening between the nitrogen and the carbonyl. Now, of course, if they really attract, you'll make a bond. That's not so interesting once the bond's made. But there'll be some where it tried to make a bond, but there were other things in those particular molecules that kept them from getting really close together. So it stopped it part way in forming a bond. And that proved out. So they had about six or seven of these cases had nitrogens getting sort of between van der Waals distance and bonding distance.
Okay.
Right? And then they look at those structures and found that of those, the nitrogens are all on the same line relative to the carbonyl carbon at 110 degrees. So that seems to be the direction they prefer to approach. Now, you could, since then, that was 1983. Since then, the size of this database is, let me guess, it's quadrupled maybe. So you could go back and do that experiment again. That would be a fun thing to do. And now find a lot more examples and see if those extra examples also fall on the same line. That would be fun to do. See what I mean?
Okay.
So they didn't actually, I mean, somebody did an experiment,
right,
did all these crystal structures, but different people did them.
Okay.
What was important was that they were collected together in a single database where people, Berge and Dunitz, could there go and get them and then look for this pathway.
Got it.
Okay.
So my question goes to slide 2, actually.
Okay, let's look at slide 2, this one here, yeah?
Yeah. So...
It's saving. So, okay.
You give the names of like 2s and 2.
Now bear in mind that those names we give are our names and no one else would use them. Because they're to make the analogy between these and atomic orbitals.
Okay, so what would like some foreign organic chemists name?
They wouldn't have names for most of them.
Okay.
Some of them they would have names. They would call this pi. They would call that pi star.
Okay.
Now, there's also the sigma CH bond.
Sigma,
but the trouble is the computer mixes it up. Right? So this is bonding between oxygen and carbon, but so is this bonding between oxygen and carbon.
Yes.
A normal person would just say there was one bond,
yes, that's right.
One single bond. But in fact, that bond is the result of some attraction that's happening here and some reaction. Some attraction that's happening there.
In that scenario, what is the in reality? What is it supposed to portray? It's supposed to portray
These are what a computer gets for the lowest. If you had nuclei in those positions, and put in one electron,
yes,
this is how they would line up.
Okay.
Right, in the lowest orbital, the next, the next, the next, the next.
Okay.
And you can see why it would be that the lowest one would be this one. Okay. But you can take that, what's real is the overall electron density.
Yes.
Okay, that's what you determine by X-ray, say. So you can take that same pi, the total electron density, and you can slice it up other ways, like make bonds and so on, but that's not these orbitals.
Okay.
It's a different way of slicing the pie. Some of them.
What I'm trying to ask is, how do we explain the orbital, shall we say, given molecular orbital theory?
Most people. Well, how would you construct it?
How would we construct an idealized form of that, shall we say? We don't need exactly every curve, but then approximate.
You know what the atomic orbitals look like. So you're going to get s, p, 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 s, so on. Mm-hmm. And you know that they might shift in their relative energies because of where the nuclei are.
Okay.
So those kinds of things make sense.
Okay, as an example, how would you look at...
That's one way of doing it, is start with the atomic orbitals and see if they work up. But another way of doing it is to start with the Lewis structure.
Yes.
And say there should be a pair of electrons in this sigma bond, there should be a pair of electrons in this, there should be an unshared pair and a p orbital on this thing, and so on. That's a different way of doing it. And that's the way most chemists would do it.
I'm still looking at the 3S shape itself, actually.
So what that is is a p orbital on oxygen, maybe hybridized, pointing out to the left.
So it's
an unshared pair orbital of oxygen.
Okay.
Right? So the normal person would say oxygen is going to make a bond, and it's going to have... And it's going to make a p orbital to make a double bond, and it's also going to have two unshared pairs. So we'd say this is one of the unshared pairs, and this is the other unshared pair.
Okay.
But what the computer finds is that they mix a little bit with CH bonds, but not as much as you'd infer from these pictures, because these are drawn at a low contour. If you drew at a higher contour, they'd emphasize the oxygen more.
Okay?
But I promised I'd do a... effect. An enol was requested. I was going to So I'll just show you. So what do you need to know to do a quantum mechanical calculation? What are we trying to find in the quantum mechanical calculation?
The orbitals.
The orbitals for what?
Of a certain nuclear arrangement.
Certain set of nuclei in certain positions. We could try all different positions, but you do one at a time.
Yeah.
Okay, so what we want an enol. Okay, so we want to build a we want to select that set of nuclei. Where are we here? We're ready to go. It's over here. Okay, so we have this menu. So what do we want to put into our enol? We want an ene.
Yeah, I forgot exactly
this. An ene is a carbon-carbon double bond, right? So there's a carbon that's ready to make a double bond. See the little double bond starting there? And now I've chosen that, so I'll click it again. And now I've got an ene, right? Four H's and carbon-carbon double bond. All I'm choosing is positions for the nuclei. And so it chooses positions based on what carbon-hydrogen distances tend to be, what carbon-carbon double bond distances tend to be, and that it's going to be planar because of the double bond. Okay, so I've chosen those, and now it's an enol.
alcohol group.
So I need an alcohol group. So I need an oxygen that's making two bonds. I'll put that here. Right? And then we'll put a hydrogen on that to be an enol. Right? Okay, but it assumes hydrogens unless you put something else there. So we've got the molecule. Right? Now, we could, I could, if I want, rotate around, I could change angles and stuff. Right? So if this is all planar, I could make it so the H is pointing up toward us or something, but let's do this one. Okay, so now I've done it. Now all I have to do is set up the calculation.
Will that change calculations, or are they going to optimize?
What?
Are they going to optimize the position?
Well, we'll see. So we're going to set up a calculation. So we want to do a calculation. Okay? Now, there are a number of choices we could make here. We want to find, if we want to find the equilibrium geometry, that means it'll calculate the energy for this thing, but also then it's going to move it a little bit, calculate again, see if the energy got lower, if it got higher, move the opposite direction, and so on, until it finds the equilibrium geometry. Let's not do that. Let's just do energy for that particular structure we already chose. Okay? Now, what kind of calculation do we want? And we want the ground state. We don't want something with electrons in the vacant orbitals. Okay? And we have to say what kind of calculation. You remember what Hartree-Fock means? I used that term once, but just once. I didn't stress it. That means self-consistent field. But simpler than self-consistent field are these other things. Like, now, molecular mechanics doesn't do any quantum mechanics at all. All it does is pretend things are springs and move it to adjust the springs. Okay, we don't want to do that. A semi-empirical one is a very low level that doesn't do any self-consistent field. We'll do self-consistent field, so we'll do Hartree-Fock. Okay? And now I have to decide what basis set to use. Right? What the atomic orbitals that we're going to make the molecular orbital are. So there'd be a minimal basis set, which is just an S orbital on hydrogen, the 1s, 2s, and 3 2p's on carbon, 1s, 2s, and 3 2p's on oxygen. Now, so that's what I'm going to do. But if I click here, you can see there are lots of different things I can choose of increasing complexity, and therefore they take longer and longer to calculate. Our molecule is a pretty simple one, so it wouldn't take long to calculate with any of them. It might take, some of these would take a little longer. And there are other, let's go back here. I could do other things here rather than self-consistent field. I could do density functional theory or correlated. Right? These are way, or Muller-Plessett. These are all ways of doing correlation calculations, much more time intensive than just doing self-consistent field, and semi-empirical is faster still. So when you take an orbital, you remember what the orbitals look like, they have those exponentials in it. It turns out to be very hard to do integrals with exponential functions. So instead of taking true atomic orbitals, you know, the kind we looked at, which are hard to do mathematically, it approximates their shape by taking Gaussians. You know, the exponential, though, looks like this. A Gaussian looks like this. So it has sort of the shape out in here, but it's not the right shape, really. So what you do is take several Gaussians. You take one Gaussian that's like this, and then a Gaussian that's like this, and a Gaussian that's like this, and add them together, and you get something that looks sort of like an exponential. Okay, and you can do a lot of fiddling around as to which Gauss, you know, how narrow you make the different Gaussians and that kind of thing, and how many you use. So 3-2-1, the 3 means you use 3 Gaussians, right? But you can also use 6 Gaussians, which Gaussians turn out to be easy to do integrals between. So that's why it uses Gaussians to do this. So let's just do this, or STO3G is the simplest of all. So just 3 Gaussians to approximate each orbital. So like a P orbital, I'm not positive about this, but I think it has 1 Gaussian to do this lobe, 1 Gaussian to do this lobe, and 1 Gaussian to sort of change their shapes to make it look more like a 3P orbital. But these are fairly crude, but they're easy to do the integrals of, so the computer does it. But if you want, you go to, you know, 631 plus G star, which puts a lot more Gaussians in there to make it look more like the real thing. Okay, so we'll just do that. And now we have to decide what we want to get out. We could compute various spectra. We can use the symmetry that the molecule has or not. We can, which is irrelevant, I think, if you just do an energy. We can calculate the orbitals and energies. We can calculate the vibrational modes, which means we would see how much energy it takes to stretch this by doing several calculations, approximate that by a parabola. Then we can calculate how rapidly things would vibrate in it. But that's going to take longer. We'll not do that. Good. Okay. So I'm going to submit it. And I have to give it a name, Enol, I'll call it. And save it on the desktop. Save. So there's the molecule. And it started and now it ended. That's how long the calculation took. Right? So now I could go to display. Okay, I can go to display, and this is look at the output, and this is the record of what we did. Right, so it says at the top that we started with we used 19 basis functions. We used we did this kind of calculation, STO3G. There were 10 atoms that were used, 10 orbitals. Is that right? Yeah, 4 on carbon, 4 on oxygen, and 2. No, wait a second. Wait a second, 10. Oh, there's 7 S shells. Carbon, carbon, oxygen. 1, 2, 3, 4 hydrogens. And 3 SP shells. An S shell is 1, right? Are there 7 atoms in this thing? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So, yeah, there's 7 atoms. So each of them has a 1S. And then 3 of them, carbon, carbon, and oxygen, have S and P. Okay? And that's how many basis functions there were, how many electrons, how many heavy atoms, 3 and 4 hydrogens. Okay? Blah, blah. Let's see this, what the symmetry of it is. Here's the energy that was calculated in atomic units. And it took 0.1 seconds to do it. And it took actually 0 seconds of CPU time. Okay, now, let's do something else. Let's go back to setup and do it. Now this time, calculation, this time we're going to minimize the energy, right? We'll do a lot of calculations to find the minimum energy geometry, right? Do one, do another, find the lowest one. Okay, so we'll submit that. Started, completed. That took longer. Okay. So now let's go to the display for that one. Output. And if we back up here, we'll see. Where is it? Here. So the first calculation, it got an energy of minus 150.9098406, right? And then it did a second calculation, having moved them, and got that it was more negative energy, lower energy, right? Then it did it again, but the last two hardly changed at all. So then it decided we're there, we'll quit this. Okay? So now we got, we've minimized the energy. Okay? And now we come down here and see the orbitals. So here are the Cartesian coordinates, x, y, z, for the four hydrogens, the oxygen and the 2 carbons, right? So you could make a picture of them if you wanted to. Okay, and then here are the MOs, the lowest, the next. Now the lowest is very low, minus 20 or 552 electron volts. An electron volt is 23 kilocalories. So this is like 10,000 kilocalories. Right, really low energy, the lowest energy electron pair. The next one is minus 301. The next one is minus 300. The next one is minus 35, an order of magnitude higher. Why? Why is there this 3 that are really low energy? And then the next one is not nearly so low. Why? Why do you get 3 really low orbitals and the others are all much higher? What molecule are we dealing with? What did we want to calculate? enol. Why are there three really low energies?
For the three central orbitals.
What?
For the three central big molecules.
Right, the 1s orbitals of the three heavy atoms that have big nuclear charge. And then when you get to the 2s and 2p, they're much higher. Okay, so what do you think the very lowest one should look like? It should be the 1s orbital of oxygen, mostly. So this column tells us which orbitals, s on hydrogen, 1s on carbon, 2s on carbon, 2pxyz on carbon, and the second carbon and the hydrogen and the oxygen. So where is it big?
113.
Here, 0.99, almost 1 of that, and that's the 1s orbital of oxygen. So here is 0.99 here. What's it going to be? Don't look at the left column. What's the next one going to be? Which carbon?
The left carbon.
The one near the oxygen, we think. So we go here. Yes, okay. Right, and then the next one is going to be the other oxygen, the 1s on that. And now we're going to start to get valence level orbitals. Right? So what do you think the lowest valence level orbital should be? The most stable electrons. Probably 2s of oxygen, right? And plus a little bit of bond into carbon. Let's see. So here we go to this one. And here it's 80% 2s of oxygen, but 20% 2s of this carbon, and only 5% 2s on the other carbon, right? And so we know that this is the carbon that's near the oxygen. Right, so that's a carbon-oxygen bond. And it probably has some, and it has a little bit of p orbital on that one too, right, making it stretch out toward the oxygen. And now we know that this is the one near the oxygen, and that indeed was the second one. So we were right. So you see how you do this. Okay, now we'd like to see what pictures of these orbitals look like. Okay, so we're going to have to calculate them. So we go back to setup, and we want to get surfaces. Okay. So now we want to add a surface. Now, how many orbitals are there? See, there are four valence electrons on each. Let's see, there are 6 for each carbon, 8 for oxygen, 12, 20, plus 4, 24. There are 12 electron pairs. Okay, so I want to calculate... the way it lets you do that is this. Okay, so we can look at the HOMO. Okay, let's calculate that one. Or we'll put that in our list. But let's also do... Actually, while we're doing it, let's do LUMO, too. We're going to see what that looks like. And you might think, what are these going to be like, you think? What's the HOMO going to be? What's the LUMO going to be? What do you think? What do you think? Well, let's draw the molecule here. The molecule is C double bond C... O, and then hydrogen's on here. So what do you think's going to be a low, yeah, Abby?
The lone pair on oxygen.
Lone pair on oxygen. In fact, there are 2 lone pairs on oxygen, right? There's going to be one pointing in and out of the board, and there's going to be one here, too, like sp squared kind of thing. Okay, so that's a good chance. Any other candidates for a low LUMO? I'm asking because there is another one.
Pi star.
Pi star of the C double bond C. So pi star is another possibility. Okay, oh, pardon me, that would be the LUMO. But pi could be a HOMO too, right? As a candidate at least. We'll see. Which is higher, unshared pair on oxygen or pi? Not easily. Okay. So we want to see what the LUMO looks like, right? And then we're going to do some others since we're doing it. We're going to add. It's a shame that you can't do this automatically. HOMO minus 1. Okay, this is 1 below the HOMO. Okay, and we'll do add HOMO minus 2. And why not do HOMO minus 3? And why not do OMO minus 4. And add HOMO minus, we said there were 12, right? Why would we do HOMO minus 11? Okay. Okay, now we have to calculate these. So go back to setup and submit again so that it'll calculate them. It's done. Okay? This kind of thing on old computers used to take, you know, an hour maybe or something like that. You can't believe how lucky you are with this. But I mean, you do different things when you have different power. Okay, which one do you want to look at? What's HOMO minus 11? The very lowest orbital of all.
Second orbital. Wait, that's the lowest. Yeah, that's the lowest.
The very lowest orbital.
Zero.
The first. Okay. So what's it going to look like?
Clump on oxygen.
It's 1s on oxygen. There it is. Now, we can if we do this, properties, and click on that. Now, we can say how we want to draw it. We could draw it as a solid. We could draw it as a mesh. We could draw it as dots. That's not so good for this one. We could draw it transparent, so you can see the atom inside, the nucleus inside. Actually, these are much bigger than the nucleus, of course. Which one do you want? Mesh, you like? Okay, and now another thing we can change, if we click on here, I think. Where is it? We can pick the contour level. But I don't see where it is. Oh, here, iso value. That's the contour level. So this is contoured at 0.03 electrons per cubic Bohr radius. What do you want? You want to make it bigger, smaller? Make it bigger. Okay. So we want to go out further out in the onion. So what should I make? Should I make this 0.3 or should I make it 0.003? 0.003. Okay. Okay. So that's 10 times less dense out there. It really is focused on the nucleus, right? Or if I did it to 0.003. Right? Now, once you get this far out, it's got a little bit of mixing with other things. But remember that practically all of it, you know, we're down by many orders of magnitude here. Practically all of it is that core of the oxygen. Okay, that was interesting. But let's take one of those away. Okay, now which one do you want to look at next? Which one? Well, I didn't calculate. What would I get if I did HOMO minus 10? I'd get a lump here. And if I did HOMO minus 9, I'd get a lump here. But HOMO minus 8 might be interesting. Let's calculate that. Okay, so I got to calculate it. Okay, so now I have to take this one away because it can plot a bunch of them. And I'll do HOMO minus 8. And now, you want to make it a net maybe instead of solid? And let's do higher density maybe, huh? Right? So it's mostly on the oxygen with a little bit of bonding to carbon. Right, it's street. And if we go to a lower contour, let's go to 0.1. We'll see more. Oops, 0.1. Now you see more how it's mixing with the carbon, and a little bit with the hydrogen too. So it's both the OH and the CH bond a little bit in this one. Well, it's made up of, it's got sigma bond between oxygen and carbon, but it's also got sigma bond between oxygen and hydrogen. Remember, this is just taking the same thing and cutting the pi different ways. So we tend to cut it along this bond, this bond, this bond, but a computer gets the lowest possible way of doing it, and that's this. Okay, so we got HOMO minus 8. Now let's make a big jump and actually look at the LUMO. I want you to predict before we go there. We're ready to click. So what do you think the LUMO is going to look like? So pi star looks like what it should be, right? Well, there'll be a sigma star, right? We have the OC sigma. There'll be the OC sigma star, but that won't be low. Sigma star got pushed way up, right?
So pi has to be low.
Yeah. Now let's think a little more. I'll show you. I think you could predict it, but let me just do it. There it is. Now I'm going to turn it on its edge. What's it going to look like if I turn it up?
It's going to be 4. It's going to be 4. Yeah. I think I'm yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So if you look at it there, what do you say it is?
Pi star.
Pi star. Okay, but it's not just that. It's also this. Right? It's mostly pi star, absolutely. But it's got a little bit of this p orbital of oxygen in it. Now, okay, so mostly it's pi star. Now I want to look at the HOMO. What do you think it's going to be? Could be pi. What else, Avi? You said before. Could be one of the two lone pairs. Which lone pair on oxygen do you think is going to be higher? This one or this one? Which one's higher in energy? The p orbital or the sp squared orbital? P doesn't have any s in it. So that should be okay. So here's the HOMO. So what is it mostly? It's the pi. But it's got that in it too. Now, let's go to HOMO minus 1. Now, that's complicated. That's complicated. Because that's made up of a bunch of different things. This is a CH, that's a CH. This is a CC, that's a CC bond, and there's also unshared pair on... This is that unshared pair on oxygen that's in the plane, right? See what I'm saying? Let's make it transparent so you can see that. Right? Partly, this is that unshared pair that's in the plane, but it's also mixed with other things. Okay, let's see if we can see HOMO minus 2, if that's any clearer. What's that? Notice that this HOMO here should mix with this double bond. Right? So it's part of the, it's not just this pi system, this is part of the same pi system. Right? You have the pi orbit, CC pi, but you also have the unshared pair on oxygen, the one that's pointing in and out. Those two things are going to mix. And this is the favorable combination of that. And it's as big on oxygen as it is on the carbons, at least at this contour. Let's change the contour. Let's go out further. Right? Now it's big on carbon when it's further out. What if I go in to 0.3? How's it going to change? Now it's on oxygen, right? Not on the carbons. See what I'm doing? I mean, I went a little too far. Let's go to 0.2. Or 0.1. Right? So that suggests that among those p orbitals that we're talking about, oxygen is the lowest. Right? This is the favorable combination of those three p orbitals. Right, and oxygen is the lowest of all, so that's favorable. And then we had the next one was this one, was it? Yeah. And now that's got a node in it, right? You can take those three p orbitals and put them together so they have no nodes, or so they have one node, or so they have two nodes. Right? And that's mostly on carbon, not on oxygen. The low one is mostly on oxygen, not carbon. Right? But from the Lewis point of view of mixing things, what's happening is this unshared pair is being mixed with the pi and pi star. So the pi star goes up in energy. So here's the carbon-carbon pi. We're just done. Pi and pi star. Here's oxygen, someplace here. This mixes with this. That goes down in energy. This goes up. But this also mixes with pi star. That goes up in energy. So we have these three. We started with three atomic orbitals. We have three molecular orbitals. Right. So that gives you the idea of how Spartan, what you put in and what you get out.
Why wasn't the HOMO 2 when the unshared pair like going out of the plane mixed with the pi star?
Say it again.
When the I think it was HOMO 2. I mean HOMO minus 2. Like when the unshared pair going why wouldn't that be lower? Because like
lower than what?
Than the like why wouldn't that be the HOMO? Because
It's HOMO minus 2. There's the HOMO, HOMO minus 1, HOMO minus 2. Let's just for fun, let's look at the others that we got here, and then we'll quit to make room for the next class. That one, that's got some of the unshared pair. That's a OH bond, I think. There. Okay, that's all we did. But you could put them all in and try to figure out what they're saying. But some of their messages are very complicated, right? Because the way the computer sliced up the pi was different from the intuitive way we do it. Okay? Pardon me?
If we ever need to draw the pi, do we just draw a stylized pi?
You don't try to match the computer. But when you see some of the computer orbitals, when you see them, you can see what's there, even though you couldn't have predicted them, right? But you can see what they're.
Thanks a lot.
So you're not supposed to be able to beat the computer at its own game. You're supposed to be able to think about it.
So we won't be able to we won't have
the computer. Right?
You don't need the computer to do what you want to do.
Okay.
The reason we've used the computer is to validate what we've been talking about.
Okay.
Right, because we can see in it some of the things that we've been talking about. You need a signature?
Mayan County's timesheets, yeah.
Yeah, just a second. Let me turn this recorder off while I'm thinking about it.